The Masterclass podcast is made on the unceded land of the Wurundjeri, Woiwurrung and Bunurong people. We recognise First Nations people as the original owners and custodians of the lands and waterways across the Australian continent. We pay our respects to elders past and present. Always was, always will be Aboriginal land.
That's the start of my story, because that was my response too. And I thought, okay, that's the way that I'm going to get the reader in.
One of the really big differences between news and features is that issue of time.
Focus on the intimate and particular. When you go to write a feature, you don't necessarily know all the answers to the questions that you've asked. Part of finding the answers is writing. You don't have to tie things up in a neat bow, but you need that sense of resolution at the end so the reader knows that they've finished. I'm Stephanie Convery, inequality reporter at Guardian Australia. Today, I'm going to give you a masterclass in writing feature stories.
Hello and welcome to Season 3 of the Masterclass podcast. I'm Louisa Lim, and I teach audio journalism and podcasting at the University of Melbourne. Every episode, we're speaking to a master of journalism to talk about one aspect of their work. Today, we're hearing from Stephanie Convery, inequality reporter at Guardian Australia, who is nominated for a Walkley for features. Steph, let's start off with the basics. What is the difference between a news story and a feature?
So news story, you are laying out the facts in order of importance. Usually you're telling the reader something that they didn't already know. A feature still works with facts, but it's a more literary, in-depth exploration of an event, a person, an idea sometimes. It's a bit more open in structure and tone than a news story, and it allows you to go a bit deeper into something that can't really be explored properly with just the facts laid out in order of importance.
So, I mean, talk us through your process. How do you get your ideas and what do you do when you've got an idea?
I don't have a particularly structured process. It kind of depends on the topic. If the reason that I'm writing the feature is that a big news event has happened and the idea is to go a bit more in depth into that event, then I would probably start by looking for people to talk to, going to the relevant places if that's significant, or even reading widely about any issues related to the event that might give me some indication of where the tension is or where the unexplored aspects of the event are. And then it depends on what comes out of that. Sometimes it's very obvious that you need to speak to people. Sometimes if I am, for example, writing about concussion in sport, which I've done quite a lot of, it's very important to talk to families. So the first thing would be to secure an interview with the family. And then from there, it depends on what the family has to say. Those interviews can be quite long. Most of them would last for about 3 hours, which is part of the way that I end up getting the anecdotes and the stories, but also part of the way that you make a subject of an interview feel relaxed and able to talk to you and able to trust you. Because with stories like that, you're dealing with people who are often very traumatized, often very hesitant, and spending time with them can help the story develop and to help them talk to you more openly. That's one way. Another way is reading very, very deeply. I wrote a piece about super yachts and it was
a long... massive yachts, right?
Huge yachts, yes. So,
like building-sized yachts.
I think the Australian definition is longer than 25 metres. So I think in America the definition is longer than 30 metres, but basically really, really big yachts. And they're usually privately owned. There are some available for charter, but most of them are privately owned.
Oh, so bigger than a swimming pool?
Yeah, bigger than a swimming pool. You can have like gyms on those boats. They're enormous. That involved a lot of reading because I didn't really know what the legal status of them was in Australia. I didn't really know what the political complications had been around allowing them in and out and what the working conditions on them were. I did a lot of reading of like industry lobby reports, government reports, financials, things like that, to kind of get a better sense of the lay of the land. And then I went and spoke to people about what was involved with the industry, what they thought about the industry, all of that sort of thing. In terms of events and places, sometimes you just have to go somewhere and feel it and take notes about the way that the wind moves or the way that things look or the little details about people that are different from maybe what you would be expecting. Even something as simple as whether somebody says hello to you on the street or not can tell you something about a place. And that obviously you would need to go and talk to people too, but sometimes your first impressions of a place can really help shape how you're going to write the feature. Because I think the important thing is that feature writing is more about showing than just kind of telling facts. It's also about allowing what you're showing to kind of do a lot of the work for the reader in understanding what's going on.
Those ingredients that you need for a really great feature story, you know, you need an angle, you need an interviewee. What else do you need?
Honestly, I try to think about feature writing a bit more like short story writing. To be clear, I was never formally trained in feature writing. I kind of did a lot of it by feel. And I started on the arts desk at The Guardian when I first started working in journalism. And that meant that I was writing a lot of features about artists. And a perhaps useful way of looking at the difference between features and news is in the arts, because when you're talking about art, a news story would be, this exhibition is happening, this is when it's happening, this is when the artist is coming, this is what they've said. A feature would be, here's what the artist has said. They're talking about this issue and this issue and this issue. If you look at that in context, these are the things that might be drawn out of that. Here's what they might have said later. Here's what their critics have said. What does that say about what the artist is doing? You know, you kind of, you're digging into the ideas and the context, and you might include also descriptive passages about the work and what that has meant to different people. So your opportunity for kind of getting into the meaty stuff kind of really expands with that. So when I talk about writing features, like a bit like writing short stories, I'm talking about character. Who are the people that you're speaking to? And not just what have they said, but what are they like? Why are they like that? Have they told you that? Have other people said that? Setting, so again, as we talked about, descriptive passages, mood, weather even. A couple of things about feature writing, and these are sort of more nuts and bolts things, but they are always usually written in present tense. And about anywhere between 1 and 5 paragraphs in, you'll have a section which is variously called a nut graph or a nub par, or I didn't actually know those terms when I first started doing it, but you can feel it in the feature. It's the anchor of the story. And that's the place where you tell the reader why they are reading this story. What is the key conceit that you're trying to explore? What is the reason that you're writing this feature? It's the way to kind of orient the reader. By the time they get to that paragraph, usually they have been drawn in by whatever you've said before that. You could start with a quote, you could start with a description, and then you tell the reader why it's important that they keep reading.
I've heard of the nut graph described as a kind of dear reader par, but I always like to think of it as a why does this story matter to you par, where you're really kind of telling people why it's important. Do you have a way that you think about that par, a question that it's answering?
I think that's partly what it does is sometimes it asks the question, and that's the question that you as the writer are trying to answer by writing the piece. I do think it is often the case that when you go to write a feature, you don't necessarily know all the answers to the questions that you've asked. Part of finding the answers is writing. I think the writing process is really important for understanding something. So you can do all the research that you want, but until you start writing, often you're not 100% clear the direction that the piece is going. At least that's my experience of it. So I kind of think of that part of the feature as me clarifying and crystallizing my own ideas about what I'm writing about. And I think it's important that you don't necessarily beat the reader over the head with that answer that you've come up with or the question that you're asking, but you do have to be very clear to them about what the importance is of reading this piece. The Strong family are an incredible sporting family.
Stephanie Convery is the inequality reporter at Guardian Australia.
Their patriarch, Terry, played rugby league for a good 2 decades.
Dad's medium of communication was sport. He was really good at sport. He knew a lot about sport. He could use sport as a way of talking to people and putting things into perspective for us as kids.
He also worked for a long time as a Telstra estimator, and for a while there also drove trucks. And Terry's wife, Kathy, spoke to me about their 44-year-long relationship and how much of a team they were.
Terry and I, we managed our finances so well over the years, so we could have a holiday overseas every year. We loved travel. We had a great group of friends. We were just loving life.
They have 2 sons. One of them, Michael, also talked to me about his dad and told me that one of his fondest memories of his dad was that every week they would have spaghetti Fridays and Terry used to do the cooking. Spaghetti bolognese was his signature dish.
Spaghetti Fridays was every week and it was just his thing and he loved it and he cooked great spaghetti, Dad.
I remember I was with some friends and he said, I'll cook spaghetti bolognese for you when you get home. It'll be ready for you.
And then all of a sudden, yeah, he just couldn't remember how to cook spaghetti.
He couldn't remember when to put the spaghetti on or when to put the onion in, and it was a real effort.
Terry died in 2021 after a rapid and very distressing deterioration into dementia.
So this is from the story that you did on concussion, and I'm really interested in the level of detail that you were able to talk about, you know, the spaghetti Fridays. Tell us about how you got to that level of detail and maybe how the interview process was different than if it had been a news story.
So when I first got in touch with the Strong family, we had a few conversations on the phone, not recorded. They weren't interview conversations. It was more about talking to the family about the process of speaking to me on the record, talking about what to expect from being involved in a big story like that. They had approached me, so they were willing to tell a story. It wasn't a question of whether they would tell it. It was more about how the process went and what would be involved. And so after a couple of those conversations, I spoke to a bunch of members of the extended family. Michael and Kathy were the only people who went on the record for the story, but the rest of the family had given their consent and understanding.
So that's the wife and the son
of
Terry Strong, the man who died from a...
Yes, from chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is a brain disease caused by repeated head trauma. So Kathy and Michael and I set up a time to do the formal interview, which was over Zoom because they were in a different state. And I have heard other journalists say that usually these interviews might take them 45 minutes, but I have done a few stories like this now and they never take 45 minutes. For me, it's usually hours. And I don't think that's a bad thing for a story like this. I think they require a lot of trust, and a lot of people have a lot of good reasons not to trust the media and not to trust journalists. So I want anybody who's sharing a story about extreme vulnerability like that, especially things that are really personal, to be able to trust me. So we had a Zoom conversation so they could see me, I could see them. I started just by asking them to tell me what Terry was like, because this is a man that they've known their whole lives mostly, and he was someone very important to them, and I wanted to get a sense of who he was, his character, his interests, his temperament. And from there, the anecdotes naturally started to come out about how he played golf, how he taught his sons golf, the spaghetti Fridays, obviously. And then at one point, the family naturally started to talk about Terry's cognitive decline, which was why we were there. And then just sort of by the by, they told me this story about Terry accidentally leaving the petrol pump in the car, as in like he'd gone to fill the car up with petrol and left the handle of the pump in the actual car and driven off and not realised and pulled the whole bowser out of the ground. And I was like, that is an extraordinary image, an extraordinary thing to happen. He was terribly mortified, but it was so striking to me. I could see it in my head and I thought, okay, that's my lead. That's the start of my story, because I see you've got your eyebrows raised, like, because that was my response too. And I thought, okay, that's the way that I'm going to get the reader in, because it's something that doesn't happen very often. It's something that's kind of catastrophic, but it's also something that speaks to the central issue of the story, which is this man's cognitive decline and the difficulties that he had and the way that it affected him and his family. So I thought, okay, well, this is going to be important. And then as the interview went on, more of that sort of stuff came out. And I also was able to then ask the family questions about what they wanted from, at the time there was a Senate inquiry into concussion in sport happening, what they wanted from that, how they felt about it, how they felt about Terry's sporting career. This thing that he loved to do has now had a profound effect on his health, and what they wanted for other people who played sport. And I think the time and the trust were the things that allowed that detail to come out. And then it was just a matter of choosing the detail to put into the story, which can be quite a difficult job when you have 3 hours of tape and so much to choose from. But I think often your instincts are right there. It's the things that you remember that stick out to you are probably going to be the key beats in your story. But once you go back through it, you can often find really, and I would recommend getting interview transcription software to help you out with that. Otherwise, it just takes way too long to transcribe interviews. Make sure you check the transcription, though, because it's not always right. But that can help you navigate a long interview and find those little gems of detail. When I did creative writing at university, one of the things that really stuck with me was my lecturer told me to focus on the intimate and particular. And I think that's actually a really good thing to remember, no matter what kind of writing you're doing. Intimate and particular will give people a really new sense of something that might be really familiar to them, but also bring the piece alive for them too.
I think we have another clip from a different story that you've written, which is about food banks.
This is We Need to Be Alarmed, Food Banks in Overdrive as Politicians Allow Australians to Go Hungry, by Stephanie Convery and Luke Henriquez Gomes.
It's a gloomy, overcast morning at Mission House, Fitzroy. At the back of the nondescript old terrace, opposite the Housing Commission flats, commonly called the high rise, a team of people in fleecy lined jackets unload vans, construct shelves, and pack plastic shopping bags full of groceries, mainly food, but also sanitary items, nappies, toilet paper, and hand sanitizer. Over the course of the morning, people trickle in through the back gate with various needs. Some pick up food parcels, others arrange a subsidy for their medication. Run by Anglicare Victoria, Mission House is open a couple of times a week to anyone who needs its services. Sima Buyuksu, who's aged 52, is one of those who drops by on the day Guardian Australia visits. She lives in the high rise, sole parenting her two youngest children, one of whom has Down syndrome. She has been coming to Mission House every month for 10 years.
I'm sensing that your process for writing that story was a little bit different. A lot of it is based around a food bank in Carlton. I mean, did you just sort of go there and observe or, you know, talk us through that process?
So that one, I had done a bit of research with my colleague Luke Henrique Gomes, and we had sort of looked at the facts and figures already. But the facts and figures needed something to hang it together that was more human, that brought the reader in. And so I arranged with Anglicare, who run the food bank, to go down to their premises on a day that they had the food bank open so that I could not only see the food coming in and being unloaded, but also speak to some of the people who were coming and picking food up. I went down to the food bank and I helped them unload a couple of the trucks. And then I sort of got chatting to some of the people who turned up. It was a little bit more stilted than a process like interviewing the Strong family, because most of the people turning up didn't expect to see a journalist there. Many of them said they would talk to me, but not with their names used or not on the record. The couple of people who did talk to me on the record meant that I could have them in the story, I could quote them, I could build a couple of characters there. But I think it is important sometimes, if you can't get anybody to go on the record in a situation like that, just to say that, you know, people here didn't want to speak to the media, because that's important for the reader to know too, if there's a distrust there among that community. And then it was sort of a matter of using that morning, that experience, those quotes and the voices of those people to hang together the different facts about food banks and need in Australia at that moment. And that was post-COVID, so the payments had fallen away. People were back on poverty payments after the COVID supplement, and food bank need was rising. That was the thrust of the story. We had the facts to show that, and this was a kind of illustration of how that played out in practice. And I think a lot of people, if you've never been to a food bank, you've never had to use a food bank, just showing the reader what it's like in a place like that, it was quite friendly. It was sort of a little bit slow, and the things that people needed were varied. But I think it was important to show the human side of that structure and why it's needed and who comes to use it.
As the inequality reporter, you're often interviewing people who perhaps don't want to be interviewed. And, you know, you're asking them to reveal things about their life that they're probably a bit embarrassed about. How do you kind of go about persuading people to talk to you? Because it really often isn't really in their interests, is it?
It's a bit of a juggling act, because I actually don't want to make people more vulnerable than they are willing to be. And I think that as an inequality reporter, just in the title alone, that suggests that my orientation should be towards the person who is experiencing inequality, not towards the person who is in power. I want the interviewee to have power. I want them to have agency. I want them to know that they don't have to reveal things to me if they don't want to. They don't have to go on record. They don't have to talk to me. But often they still will. I think a lot of the success of that comes from building that trust again. That's really key to it. If I'm trying to get somebody to trust me, if I'm trying to talk to somebody who is a little bit reluctant, kind of wants to tell their story, but is feeling a bit like, this might be too much for me. I don't know if I want to be in the newspaper, but I feel like this injustice that's happening is too much. Just talk to them about the pros and the cons of that. Because often, counterintuitively, by telling your story in the media, if the story is treated fairly and you're, as a subject of the story, given a certain amount of agency in the story, in the way that it's told, as much as anything, often the thing that was happening to you can be partly remedied. Like it's really annoying because and upsetting and infuriating that one of the ways that the system works is that people are oppressed by our social structures and our welfare structures and things like that. And then when they speak out about it, the particular thing that's oppressing them, it can often be fixed because it's been aired in the media and the government doesn't like that. So that is often a reason why people come to the media. You have to be a bit careful about that, but it's also something that you can often say with a fair amount of confidence that it's more likely to be resolved if you speak out about it.
And one of the really big differences between news and features is that issue of time. With a news story, you've probably got a deadline. You're summing up the news of the last day or hour. And so it's very finite. Whilst the problem with features is often there's no particular deadline. You can go on and on interviewing people and reading documents and doing research. So how do you know when to stop? How do you know when you've got enough?
You need a word count. You've probably got a word count as a student. I would say set yourself a deadline. Like give yourself 2 days. If by the end of 2 days you don't have enough material for a feature, you're doing something wrong. I mean, it might not be the best feature in the world, but you'll have enough to write, I don't know, 1,000 words. There aren't actually that many elements that you can fit in there. So if you've done a couple of interviews, you've got a couple of talking heads, you've done a little bit of research, you've probably got enough. The other thing that I think about with features is the ending. You don't have to tie things up in a neat bow, but you need that sense of resolution at the end so the reader knows that they've finished. And I like to think about that like in music. A cadence is that da da, that kind of resolution, that sort of drop in notes at the end of a melodic phrase. Usually, like we think about it with chords at the end of a song, like you get this sense of finality, like, okay, I'm done here. This piece is done. So I try to make sure that there is like a cadence at the end of a feature. It can be a quote that you think is really poignant. It can be an image. In the super yacht story we were talking about before, the image was just of this boat sinking and the whales just swimming. I liked that because it, without telling the reader what I thought, I felt like that image kind of gave the reader a sense of where I was coming from as a writer. In the feature about Terry Strong, it was a quote from his son. I think I sort of skipped over it when I was first doing the interview. And then later when I was going through the transcript, I was like, oh, that's exactly what this whole issue is about, looking after people.
You've given us so much good advice about how to write features, but what are your 2 top tips for students?
If you're struggling, and this is something that one of your colleagues, Dr. Jeff Sparrow, often says, and it's always helped me. If you're struggling and you can write a decent sentence, 90% of your problem is structure. So think about your structure. Think about where you're going to put each of these pieces and how they flow logically from one to another. Sometimes you can fix that with just a couple of linking sentences. Sometimes you might need to do a bit more kind of playing around. It may also be that you don't have a piece of information, but once you've figured out the structure, you can usually figure out what you're missing from the information that you have. The other thing is that you don't need to spell everything out for the reader. And I think it can be really tempting to think about features a little bit like opinion pieces in that you're trying to make an argument or you're trying to push a particular perspective on the reader. Don't do that. You might have a perspective that you're trying to kind of bring across, but you want to let the facts speak for themselves as much as they possibly can. Yes, you're doing more description than a news story. Yes, you're kind of exploring ideas a bit more than you would in, well, certainly more than you would in a news story, but you still don't want to be didactic. And often it's better to keep yourself out of it, I think, too. You're writing as a journalist about the world around you and the people that you're speaking to. So I think it is important that even though you're bringing yourself to it, you're not talking about yourself because the story is not about you. They're my tips.
Fantastic. Thank you. And I think you've got a task for students.
So my task for you is to find a feature story, analyze its structure, and identify the nut graph or the nubpa, whatever you want to call it, and write a couple of sentences about why this feature is effective in telling you more than a news story would.
That was Stephanie Convery, inequality reporter for Guardian Australia. The Masterclass is produced by Dylan Bird and myself. It's edited by Dylan Bird. Sound design and post-production by John Chia. The original concept is by Anders Furs. The theme tune is by Susie Wilkins. It was partially funded by the GEM Scott Trust and is brought to you from the Centre for Advancing Journalism at the University of Melbourne.